This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Hamlet's GM Screen.
The Rakuro QB.
Jared Twing.
And the Dead or Missing Scientists Flap.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady. Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys. And Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
We are going to open the closet and check out the Trilby, the Derby, the Silk Topper, the Deer Stalker, and the baseball cap because we find ourselves, as we often do, exchanging the covert self-promotion of the regular episode for the overt self-promotion of Among My Many Hats. And Robin, today, your hat is, it's a sort of a Danish royal crown, but not the crown of the king, sadly, the crown of the prince, the melancholy Dane. Maybe it's a melancholy hat. I don't know, like a black toque. Anyway, the point being that we are here to discuss your sequel to Hamlet's Hit Points, much beloved examiner of story beats for the purposes of story and gaming, with Hamlet's GM Screen, a book that focuses the Hamlet's Hit Points story beat system onto specific problems at the game table, and specific, I guess, problemtunities, really, because it's also about making the upbeats happen as well as handling the downbeats. So do you want to lay out what caused Hamlet's GM Screen to spring from your brow like Athena?
Yeah, so Hamlet's GM Screen, which will be available in the Pelgrane web store as of July, is a book that comes out of the number one response or request or call to action from Hamlet's Hit Points, which, for those of you who don't know it, takes three classic narratives that I figured nearly everybody knew or could easily get to know, which would be the Hamlet, of course, good old William Shakespeare's Hamlet, mm-hmm. Casablanca, and the film version of Dr. No. And it analyzed them moment by moment. The reason being, to go back even further to explain why that came into existence, is that in certain rule books that I wrote with a sort of a narrative slant, and I'm thinking particularly of the original what is now HeroQuest and what then was Hero Wars, I would often say, yeah, just, you know, follow what would make for an interesting story at this point. This is a story-driven system. Use your knowledge of story. And then it turned out that not everybody has an innate knowledge of story, even though they observe lots of stories. They aren't analytical in the way that I am. So Hamlet's Hit Points, which started on LiveJournal, to show you how long ago that came out, was basically an exercise in breaking down a narrative, and not in the big structural way that you will find in a screenwriting book, or that you'll find, or in the big sort of thematic motif way that you'll find in Northrop Frye's Anatomy of Criticism, but the sort of moment by moment emotional notes that go up and down and engage you with the story. And the reason for that is that in role-playing, structure either sort of take care of itself, either being provided to you by a structure that's in the game, the way that Gumshoe has a structure embedded in it, or it doesn't matter so much because you're not trying to shoehorn people into a structure. You're trying to make each individual moment exciting and interesting and emotionally aware. And so the purpose of Hamlet's hit points was to get people to look at how stories work on the moment-to-moment basis and then internalize them so that they can then take those to the gaming table. And so when the question comes up to them, well, what would be the interesting thing to do here? They could think, oh, well, I need a downbeat because the things have been going too well, or I need an upbeat because things have not been going well enough, and I'll adjust the difficulty accordingly. Or, well, we've had a lot of information gathering. I guess we should have a challenge, have a procedural problem to solve. Or we've had a lot of procedural adventure. Maybe this would be a moment for some drama or interaction. So that's what Hit Points is trying to do. Often the response that I got to that from people, and as you point out, it's been bizarrely successful for something you would think of as kind of abstruse, was, but what about the gaming table? Can you be even more specific about how I would apply these to an actual game? And so people were essentially asking for more directly actionable advice about turning specific gaming moments into more interesting versions of themselves. And so that's exactly what Hamlet's GM screen turns out to do, which is to imagine a series of game moments and then study the types of moments and whether they lead to an upward emotional spike or an emotional downbeat. And that turned out to be oddly challenging because for Hamlet's hit points, I just had to look at an existing narrative and study that. But here I had to make up the narrative that was happening at the game table, essentially writing extended examples from different genres and then analyzing them, which was surprisingly tricky, but I think pays off in terms of providing, you know, actionable advice that you can think about in a more concrete way when you head to your own gaming table.
Yeah. So the specific use case, I guess, if you get Hamlet's GM screen, well, first of all, read it and savor every word of your limpid prose. But also, there's a lot of sort of common things that happen at the table or situations even that you then sort of examine in beat form from an archetypal perspective. Like, you know, we're trying to get through the stubborn door, or we're trying to solve a mystery, and then you sort of lay out the beat platform for that specifically. Is there one of these that you think is less usual in the sense of people will be delighted to see this as opposed to people will expect to see it and nod sagely when it shows up?
Well, I guess the nod sagely part is they will see my theory as to why it's never interesting to fail to get information laid out with diagrams. The things that may surprise people more are, first of all, that it looks at the session zero in terms of its emotional beats.
Yeah.
The characters aren't even on stage yet. You haven't even made them up, but a stronger jamming experience will still pay attention to how engaged the players are by the process of doing all this creative work and will pay more attention to keeping people's attention and watching how sometimes they're disappointed when they discover something in the rules. Sometimes they're excited about different possibilities and things you can do to keep that moving and have a sense of momentum to that, just as you will then expect to have a sense of momentum to the actual sessions, one through whatever, that you then run in subsequent weeks. And if you are designing something for print, for example, that can lead you to start to think of, well, what's happening at the table when we do this? Is it the most exciting thing to give everybody a sheet with a 500-word bio on it? Or should I get everybody interacting with each other right away? Or is it exciting to have people tinker with their numbers on a pre-gen? Or is that going to take up time at the beginning and introduce a lot of kind of dull procedural, like not procedural in terms of problem solving, but in terms of bookkeeping beats?
Right.
Should I just skip that part? Is it actually more engaging to do that? And the question, what is engaging, what is emotionally compelling to people, is one that I think, although my work in Hamlet's Hit Points and the work of many other people in the story movement have changed things over the years, that we still don't think of enough in terms of what is happening to the mood of the room and what can I do to take that most important dynamic and make it work optimally so that everybody leaves at the end thinking they had a great time.
The sort of approach of the book is this sort of analysis of the stereotypical role-playing experience with sort of the sort of Hamlet's hit points advice, vary the beats, make sure you've got upbeats and downbeats, make sure that the story flows and hangs together and isn't a series of monotonous reveals. Where do you think this sort of technical explication of good GMing lies when next to, say, Robin's Laws of Good Game Mastering, which in my memory is a lot of it about figuring out your players and wrangling them as opposed to at the table, what does it look like when you're trying to get through a door or have a fight with a monster? Is that, where would you say that the join is or that seam?
Yeah, I would say that Robin's Laws of Good Game Mastering is the 101, and Hamlet's GM screen is like the 201 or 301. It's like, you know, it's not grad school quite level, but it's kind of getting there. But specifically trying to take something that is ephemeral and emotional and hard to get your arms around and to package it in a highly analytical way to appeal to the mental profile of many of us gamers. And so to give people an analytical way to be emotionally vivid. But on the other hand, Robin's Laws of Good Game Mastering is more of a meta view. First of all, it's a very slim book.
Right.
Yeah. And this is more of a sort of an intensive drill down into all of the different moments and finding sometimes surprising things. Like there's a bit where it analyzes the beats of the total party kill and sort of discovers that, oh, the real emotional beats of a TPK continue on long after the moment where that occurred, as you know, hang around later and tell war stories. You know, you go to the cafeteria at the convention and talk about this thing where you downed the dragon, but he killed everybody else and what an amazing game it was. And so that leads to consideration of that in terms of almost like, you know, everybody losing their minds in a horror game and being shipped off to the asylum. Well, a TPK is sort of like that in F20 play, except the TPK has to be spontaneous. It can't be engineered the way right. that the horror spiral is. And so I think that's an interesting insight that I did not plan to have when I started writing this book. And I think the key thing to why both of these books work and are interesting is that I am describing my process of understanding how all of these moments work as we go along. Sometimes, as with giving out information, I confirm my priors, but other times, like the TPK, I am surprised at what I discover by analyzing these moments.
Well, you are such a practiced interlocutor that you have already answered the next question I was going to ask, which is, did anything surprise you about your own gaming when you were doing this analysis? And since you've already answered my question, I guess the only thing that we can do now is wait for everyone else to get questions once they've picked up Hamlet's GM screen, available on the Pelgrane web store in July. And speaking of ads, here's another one. In a hole in the ground, they found a body.
I know! Here we are in Marysher, right in the middle of the beautiful bucolic riding.
So bucolic.
With its neat hedgerows, and picturesque taverns, and delightful crumpet shops, and quaint little village greens.
Yeah, can we go back to the crumpets?
Yes, so what did you want to know about them?
I wanted to have some crumpets and shut off the recording.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, we're back. What were we saying?
Murder!
Murder?
Yes, we've got murder to solve.
In the bucolic riding? Where all the halflings live?
Yes, the halflings. Plus also some boggarts, pukas, and dwarves. hours, but weren't we concerned about something?
Murder?
Yes, murder! Another case in need of sleuthing by a team of amateur detectives.
It would be unthinkable if this wasn't the third murder this week.
Maryshire Detective Club is a fantasy mystery-solving RPG.
By the master of fantasy and mystery.
And fantasy mystery.
Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
Investigate crimes, question eccentric neighbors, stop for tea and cakes, unravel puzzles, and get involved in pedantic arguments about jam.
Wait, what kind of jam?
In the most adorable,
but still murdery,
gumshoe game yet, you gather clues, uncover motives, follow gossip, question suspicious neighbors, stop for lunch, get sidetracked. Remember, you're supposed to be solving a case. Gather some more clues. Question more eccentric locals.
Possibly chase a swan or something.
And slowly piece together the truth.
Coming soon to Backer Kit from Pelgrane Press.
Type Backer Kit and Maryshire into your favorite search engine to find the launch page. It's time once more for that most dangerous of huts. The huts where we have to wear our armor and strap on our shields and have our special magics, preferably with +3 against whatever monster type we're going to encounter, because yes, indeed, it is the monster hut. This time around, someone quite lovely in the monster hut. Someone looks totally human who we can interact with, and I'm sure nothing will go wrong. Oh, no! The Rakuro Kyuubi is here, and she is stretching out her neck toward us, and it's terrifying. And, oh, in some cases, not all cases, but in some cases, her head is detaching, because this is, I think, one of the archetypal yokai, the strange creatures of Japanese mythology, or perhaps just Japanese fantastic literature, because they come along relatively recently, and they can fulfill all sorts of roles and belong to my favorite monster type, the interactive monster, the one who can appear human, who you can have a conversation with, perhaps even a series of encounters with before you find out that they're monstrous. And the Rakuro Kyuubi might be a horrible monster, or might be a monster pal, might be a monster friend. So Ken, tell us how the Rakuro Kyuubi comes about.
Either they are, as you say, yokai, which is, it's often translated ghosts. In my head, I translate it fairies, because they're the sort of weird beings that exist on the margins of the universe, but they're really just yokai. But also, especially as the Rakuro Kyuubi comes into its own, a lot of it is, especially under the influence of Buddhism, considered people who have bad karma, either from their past life or they were adulterers, and so they were punished by having their neck stretch out. Their head can't stay on their body because of their mind-body differentiation, their war with themselves. So their head sort of falls off the bed, and sometimes it flies around, and that's a different monster. The Nuka Kyuubi, which is probably the older version, and we'll get to that, but the fun Rakuro Kyuubi's head falls off the bed, and it turns out their neck is just that long now, and then it keeps extending and extending and extending like elongated man. And the head can sort of move around on its own on the end of the neck. It does mischief. It drinks lamp oil a lot. That's one of the things it does. It scares people because it is preternaturally scary looking, even more than a head on the end of a neck would be. And sometimes it spies on folks. It, you know, sends its extensible neck in to spy out the actions of other people. And that is sometimes fun neighborly gossip. And sometimes it's, oh no, they're spying on the virtuous samurai because they're bad. And so the go from mysterious fairy to moral lesson to superhero. Well, it doesn't just happen in Western comics. It also happens in the Edo era, which is when the Rakuro Kyuubi shows up. It's usually a female Rakuro Kyuubi, but there are records and stories of male ones. Like a werewolf, you can be a Rakuro Kyuubi and not know it. You sort of wake up and you're like, boy, my neck is tired. And everyone's like, oh my God, someone drank all the lamp oil. And you're like, well, I guess it got nothing to me. Sometimes they have a distinct or significant bruise on their neck, especially afterwards. And someone can notice that they're a Rakuro Kyuubi that way. Occasionally, well, you keep the same face. You don't always get a weird, scary demon face. So someone just recognizes you and say, get out, you're a Rakuro Kyuubi, and you don't know that you are, but you are. The way to stop it is to bind the sleeping body with sacred mulberry bark or salt-infused hemp ropes. That stops the neck from extending. I guess it ties your head and neck spiritually together. The name, Rokuro, means pulley or potter's wheel or umbrella staff, and Kubi means neck. So it's a pulley neck or a potter's wheel neck, a neck that sort of spins out a great long length of neck or clay or rope. And anyway, as I said, it becomes a thing in the Edo period, starting 1603. That's when the Edo period starts. And it's maybe based on drawings of the Nukakubi, which is the yokai whose head fully detaches and flies around causing trouble. And the confusion sort of is a constant thing, even in the Japanese sources. So the Shokoku Hyaku Monogatari, the first collection of the 100 scary stories, also calls the Nukakubi a Rokubi. And that is in 1677, which may be the first time the word shows up. The first one I could trace anyway. Again, a 1713 encyclopedia, the Wakan Sansai Zue, which adapts a Ming text, describes Nukakubi as Roku Rokubi, and says that they're barbarians dwelling in a foreign land, the land of Daishaba. And Lafcadio Hearn also has a great kaidan called Roku Rokubi, which is a story about five Nukakubi. So we see the term get used over and over again, which I think goes to the argument that everything began as Nukakubi, and then they came up with a cool new word, and then it turned into this neck stretchy monster. And the theory is people would draw the Nukakubi, and to keep everyone understanding where the head came from, they'd draw like a helpful line pointing to the body, and then later people would say, is that a very skinny neck? That would be scary and cool. And so they just sort of emerged thusly. There's a Chinese monster called the Faituman, the Japanese also call the Rakuto, and it shows up in lots of Chinese texts. And once the Tokugawa sort of shut off their connection to China, then the monster would drift with the depiction, you know, because you don't have the Chinese stories coming in and reminding everyone, oh, right, no, that's a Nukakubi. Sorry, we're all wrong. So by 1756, we have the first story that I'm able to trace of sleeping women whose necks extend. And this is by the sort of social satirist Baba Bunko. And he writes it down in his collection of anecdotes, Tosai Buya Zokudan. And then in 1760, there is the first of the urban legends of Roku Rokubi, or I guess rural legends. I'm not sure how built up Hongoku is, but that's where they had one. 1760, she's called a Roku Rokubi. People make fun of her, and she's like, no, I just have a long, beautiful neck. And she marries one of her suitors who says, I don't think you're a yokai at all. And on the wedding night, sure enough, he sees her neck extend, and so he divorces her. And then she marries a doctor from the town of Kanda, and he cures her. And the way that other sources say you cure a Roku Rokubi is you feed them white dog liver that has been prepared with sake and ginger. And so I guess that's how the doctor from Kanda cures the Roku Rokubi of 1760. But it sounds, between that and the mulberry ropes, you've got countermeasures possible.
So in that version, the Roku Rokubi is a type of person with a weird, perhaps supernatural ailment.
Right,
rather than a yokai, a completely different sort of being than us, and one who can, you know, be redeemed and get married and presumably have kids. We don't hear about the kids having long necks either. So this runs the gamut from they're a supernatural being to this is a condition that can happen to people, which I guess is what brings us back to the lycanthrope analogy, right? That they have one foot in humanity and one foot in monsterdom.
And certainly there are plenty of stories where yokai marry people and then the bridegroom discovers that it's a yokai and hilarity ensues.
Right. That's a wider motif too. That happens all the time with ghosts. Mm-hmm. There's a number of great movies drawing on Japanese ghost mythology where the beautiful but mysterious bride says, well, there's just one question you can never ask me, or there's this box you can't look in. And of course, inevitably the dumb groom ruins everything by discovering that his otherwise perfect marriage is to a ghost, and then everything falls away.
And as you say, a very common folk motif goes into medieval Europe with the swan maidens and everything else. So Toriyama Sekien, the great ukiyo-e print master, sort of says, all right, enough of all this, people using words wrong, I'm going to list all the yokai in a big compendium. And the first volume, the 1776 volume, has the next stretchy lady as the Roku Rokubi. So he's laying down the law as to which of these is the Roku Rokubi and which of these is the Nuka Kubi. So thank you, Toriyama Sekien, for setting that out.
Yeah, one of the first monster manuals.
Right. And then either before or after that, it begins showing up in kabuki plays. I was not able to figure out which play was the first next stretchy lady play, but they start doing it with sort of shadows and fun special effects, and also with sort of like really extending your neck out and staring at the audience in a scary way. Then they start doing magic lantern shows once those become a thing, showing neck stretching special effects. That's great.
Right. And they get into shaggy dog stories as well. There's apparently a tradition of elaborate anecdotes about fairies. That's the water transportation, not the winged being. And one of the famous ones is about a ferry that is so crowded with people that one of the passengers is so hungry they can't get noodles on their boat. And so they stretch their neck all the way over to the other less crowded boat to eat its udon noodles. And presumably there's wordplay in there that is inaccessible to us just right, looking at the summary of the story. Now, not everybody loved these stories or loved neck stretchy women subverting the difference between humans and monsterdom, because the snooty upper class, the samurai of the early 19th century, who are at that point very cultivated and don't use their katana very much, there's an edict in 1808 where they forbid stories specifically about flying heads, animal goblins, serpent monsters, fire demons, and accounts of the atrocities and manners of vicious women. And at least two of those could refer to our beloved friend, the Rokuro Kubi.
Yeah, and this is, like always, whenever the stage gets really hot, a bunch of Pecksniffs try and ban it. This happens to Shakespeare's successors, and it certainly happens to these monster plays and monster stories that are hugely popular in Japan, like I said, in the 18th century and then into the 19th. And that edict, apparently, some bright spark says, well, it doesn't say anything about displaying them. So they start showing up in freak shows, and there is a
record. Just take out the narrative part. Leave in the monsters.
Right. There's one in 1810 where there was a male Roku Rokubi who appeared in the freak show. And so take that, the law. And the sort of ukiyo-e horror genre begins to sort of wane a little bit after that great peak in the, coincidentally, Gothic Japan era, as well as Gothic Europe. But it's still a thing, and it's still in drawings and various compendia going into the 19th, but it's sort of self-consciously a throwback type of monster. And then eventually, as happened in the West, where you take the popular entertainment of the past and recycle it into mass entertainment. It happens in Japan, and yokai show up in movies. And most specifically, Robin, the Yokai Monsters trilogy, which I have not seen. So tell us about it.
So these are a lot of fun. They were done in 68 and 69. There's not a strict continuity between them, but certain characters recur and the tone is different. The first one, 100 Monsters, directed by Kimiyoshi Yoshida, is a more serious horror film in tone. The second one, Spook Warfare, they realize, oh, wait, the yokai are the heroes. They should be assisting the put-upon-human good guys in getting comeuppance against gangsters and corrupt samurai and so forth. And so Spook Warfare is more silly and fun and has a bit of a parallel with Sid and Marty Krofft. And Along with Ghosts is the last one, and that's the second one is directed by Yoshiyuki Kuroda, and then the third one is directed by both of those two directors. They've recently been restored and reissued in beautiful versions, which I watched on a streaming platform, and you can get on disc as well. And so they're a lot of fun. And they would have blown my tiny mind if I had seen those as a kid at the same time I saw the Godzilla movies.
Right.
The Kappa in particular is a delight, but also the Rokuro Kubi. She shows up in all three of those and shows the usefulness of her spying powers. More recently, Takashi Miike in 2005 made Yokai Wars, which
I have seen.
Not a direct remake of those things, but definitely a huge homage and is his most fun, enjoyable kids movie. And that also has the Rokuro Kubi as well as many other classic yokai in it. And there have been other follow-ups to that which I gather are as interesting. And there's even like an anime version of Hellboy that has the Rukura Kubi and other yokai in it.
Because, as Elongated Man proves, you can't keep a good, sensible neck down. So the Rukura Kubi, as you say, it's a human-y type monster. It's one that you can dicker with. It's one, unless you have the rare, very rare vampire-y one, more often the Nuka Kubi are the vampires. But I assume in a Knights Black Agents game, you could have a vampiric Rukura Kubi, which would be more of a threat. And also you'd probably want to play up the inhuman features as well as the difficulty of shooting a very thin, extensible neck. But it's also a monster that can say, no, no, don't kill me. I've sent my neck around and I can see all kinds of stuff. I can spy out wherever you want to go and I'll be your reliable scout for this next time if you don't kill me. And then the question is, are you going to be reliable or is your bad karma going to come back and bite us like your neck is or your head?
And if you're taking inspiration from the latter yokai movies, she could be a fun player character type. She could be your stealth. She could be your face character who talks to people and charms them. And then when they're not looking, sends her head up to the third floor to see what they're really doing and eavesdrop on them. And a team of yokai adventurers, I think, could be a lot of fun. And you could do that in the Edo period, or you could do that in the modern day as well.
Well, once we have turned the whole circle around into player characterdom, I feel like we have, whatever else has gone on, we've exited the monster hut. So let's exit the monster hut and see with our extensible necks if there's a cool ad in the offing. Play the King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, the King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality-shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Make sure this podcast does not resolve into a do by joining beloved Patreon backers
Martin Rundquist,
Matthew Preston,
Sikander,
Derek Heimforth,
and Robert Wolf.
Welcome once again to Ken and or Robin Talk to Someone Else. And today I, Ken, am in the sunny confines of San Marcos, Texas for ChupacabraCon, which means I am talking to, I would say, one of my longest running ChupacabraCon buddies, Jared Twing, game designer, raconteur, bon vivant, a guy that I've seen around this show since I've been coming to the show. And finally, he's got a project worth plugging, and that's what we're going to talk about in a bit. But first, you know, let the global podcast audience know the Jared Twing story. What's going on?
Yeah, sure. So about 8 years ago, I was trying to do exactly what I'm doing today, make a product for myself. I've been gaming for decades and decades, way too long. And I was moaning to a friend of mine, Jason Dural, that this is really hard. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could just go write for somebody else. And he said, you should come write for me. So I've spent the last 8 years bouncing around between contracts with Chaosium, Modifius, Cubicle 7. But the majority of my work has been with BRP products with Chaosium. So I've written for RuneQuest, Lords of the Middle Sea. Last year, I had the Order of the Stone released for Call of Cthulhu. And so that's what I've been doing, trying to build that skill set.
Right.
And a little over a year ago, I was like, okay, I think I know enough here, at least about the writing part. Now I want to learn about how the publishing part works.
That's a terrible mistake. Don't. If I can give you one piece of advice too late, it is don't do that.
Yeah, it's
your first instincts were correct.
It's a completely different job. I'm really enjoying it and I'm having a great time. My number one goal was to get a product that was completely mine into other people's hands.
Yeah.
And, you know, check, success. The Hearth and the Harrowing has been released a little over a month now. I'm getting a lot of really positive feedback and I'm having a great time with it. But to your point, it is a lot of work and very different than just writing on contract.
Yeah. Well, since you have sort of opened the door to the plug, tell people about the Hearth and the Harrowing. It's basic role playing.
Yes.
BRP. And it is survival horror.
Yes.
But it's in a fantasy realm.
Yes.
Not in what you and I would consider Earth, and so therefore already wrong. But lay it out. What's the elevator pitch for the Hearth and the Harrowing?
Sure. So the quick elevator pitch is it is a BRP-based, OSR-inspired survival fantasy horror game in a land of muskets and magic. And the reason that we went fantasy, the royal we.
Me and the frog in my pocket.
Exactly. That I went fantasy is, one, I have a love of fantasy for a long time.
Right.
And but two, the time period that I want this set in is, we'll just call it a problematic time period in history. Uh-huh. And I wanted not...
Unlike the rest of history,
which of course,
smooth sailing.
I wanted to not focus on the colonialism of the time and instead focus on the horror and the muskets and the magic. Mm-hmm. And so putting it in a fantasy realm allowed me to, you know, shed those shackles and really lean into the parts I wanted to lean into.
Right. And so when you say fantasy and OSR, we've got elves, we've got halflings, we've got dwarves. It's not just humans.
Correct.
Against the encroaching undead or whatever.
Right.
And it is undead, right? The corpses have been raised by some magic spell or other.
Is that my understanding? It's not undead. It is, they're called the Corrupted, and they're more Resident Evil mutants than walking
dead. Rage zombies, not proper zombies.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you still get that, you know, mindless, they just want to corrupt you or kill you or eat you, but not the, you know, oh, they're actually walking corpses. There is that too, but they're not the main antagonist.
And also no one can cast Turn Undead and make them go away and ruin everyone's life.
Exactly.
Right. So the thing that is interesting to me most about the Hearth and the Harrowing is the hearth, and sort of lay out the central concept of that, if you will.
So I've done some design in video games as well. And one of the things we look at in video game design is systemic design and systems. Obviously, we do it in the tabletop side too, but having more of a game loop than what a lot of TTRPGs, it's not that they don't have them, they don't really advertise them. And I really wanted to be very clear that this is a game about you build something and then you go out into the wilds and go on an adventure, find more people to help you build that something and the resources you need and then bring it back and have this loop of hearth phase, adventuring phase, hearth phase, adventuring phase. That was very clear to the players. It all came from working on the equipment guide for RuneQuest. They asked me to write a chapter about improvements to lands. So in RuneQuest, you can have a noble who has some number of hides of land, or you can be a priest with a temple that is in control of some lands. And they really wanted to have some rules around improving those lands and you know, just have a little bit more system there. And when I was playtesting that with my players, and I've seen this time and time again, players really love to latch their teeth onto something. You know, it's the old ninth level, I get a keep.
Yeah. Well,
then what? Right.
Right.
And in newer games, there's bastion systems or stronghold systems, whatever they call them. But they always, to me, feel like a bolt-on.
Right.
And I wanted it to be a core part of the game.
Organic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
in the way that it is in Pendragon, for example.
Yeah. Pendragon's a good example. The Mutant Year Zero and Forbidden Lands have a more core in the system. So in those games, same sort of thing where you have something that you're building and you're foraying out into the wilds to find something.
Like Mouse Guard is another example of that.
I haven't played that one, but I believe you.
Yeah. And that's really the thing that intrigues me, because although Greg pioneered it with Glorantha in earliest RuneQuest days, it was never
core play cycle to the extent that I think Greg wanted it to be and that the setting implied it should be.
Right.
And then Pendragon sort of was Greg saying, no, this is what I mean.
Right.
This is how to do it. And then, like everything else great in Pendragon, was ignored completely. And you get Ray Winninger's Underground as another example of characters influencing and improving their setting as opposed to just getting a bigger and better axe.
Right.
I think maybe in story games, The Quiet Year, were any of those signposts for you as you were doing it?
They weren't, but, you know, outside of TTRPGs, if you look at the art of the game, everybody immediately sees Darkest Dungeon.
Right.
And that is one of our signposts, one of the things. And again, in that game, you have this city that you're developing, and then you're running off into the dungeons to go crawl for loot and that sort of thing.
Right.
So that whole cycle of build up your hearth and then go on an adventure. I mean, so many games have it, but I wanted it to be very clearly the core and the heart of the game.
Right. And that, I think, is what makes this stand out from even from survival horror as a subgenre, because so much of survival horror from Romero on down is the notion that there is no hearth. Your hearth is an illusion. Your hearth is temporary. Your hearth at most is a weakness that you've given yourself like a dummy. And to counter that with a humanistic approach, I think, first of all, it's refreshing. And second of all, I think it creates richer, better, deeper play. Absolutely. If you're playing for something else besides my plus 7x now.
Yeah.
And to what extent within the hearth do you go to the other sort of Romero well in survival horror of other survivors who are wrong or other survivors who have different opinions? To what extent are your heroes sort of the lords of the hearth the way that they would be in Pendragon? And to what extent do you have to engage in political play? And is that up to the GM, in fact?
Well, so the book comes with a region, and we're planning to put more regions out. And those regions certainly have other groups that you can run into. One of the other signposts for good or bad is the Walking Dead series.
Right.
You know, you have that same sort of thing where Rick and his crew are building their own settlement. I forget what their one in Virginia is called, but they have this settlement where they're going out into to find other survivors and bring them back. And you end up in the later seasons of the series with like three different friendly settlements that are working with each other. And in the same way, the region that we've set out, there are all sorts of bad things for you to find out there, i.e. the survival horror part. But there's also the, you know, other groups who, you know, spoiler alert, most of them are led by bad people too.
Right.
Right. Yeah. But it's your chance to impact not just your own hearth, but impact other settlements out in the wilds and make them better and make them allies and, you know, continue that hex crawl out from there.
Yeah. And when you look at Hearth and the Harrowing play, it sounds like you've got a very strong activity cycle model. Do you have a vision that is sort of default player character group? Or is this an attempt to say, maybe you're dwarves extending a mine, maybe you're elves replanting a forest, maybe you're doing something other than building a palisaded fort that gets ever larger as you accumulate grain?
Yeah, I mean, the hearth system is intended to be expanded on by the GM. And we will, of course, with further, with success, as we build more regions, we're going to add more rules and more things. But any one of the pieces of the hearth that you build, you can skin however you want. I've had players say, well, you have a field and a farm, but I actually want, you know, a fishery. Okay, you can get the same exact effect of producing more food as I put labor into it and skin it however you want. So I would encourage game masters who are looking at that tech tree of here's all the buildings that we've said that the players can build, how much they cost, skin it however you want. If it's elves building a forest, like what is the game benefit for building that forest for the hearth? Or are they just doing it to be magnanimous? Like there can be that as well. But yeah, there's all sorts of ways that you can skin it however you'd like as you build that hearth out for you and your villagers that are helping you.
And I do want to come back to the muskets part of this. What was the notion behind introducing black powder? Is it just that survival horror is not the same without shotguns? Or is it that there was something specific about that sort of 17th century vibe that you wanted in play?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it was more once I had the concept of the hearth, I had to find an interesting place to put it. Like, what was this world going to be? Because, like, it all started with the hearth phase and the adventuring phase. And I didn't want it to be, you know, throw another fantasy log on the fire. I wanted it to be to stand out a little bit in its setting. And I love Solomon Kane and Brotherhood of the Wolf and Sleepy Hollow and this kind of like creepy musket era, you know, going into the dark woods and that sort of thing. You know, it's just an aesthetic that I like. I cannot oversimplify how much I love gothic horror, but I feel there's been a lot of gothic horror done. And this is an area that hasn't been as
tapped. Puritan horror is relatively untapped.
Yeah. And so that was the decision there, is like, I wanted to stand out a little bit, but I love the idea of, as the horde of not quite zombies are coming at me, that I can fire off a pistol and then I have to discard it and switch to my sword or my axe because I don't have the two rounds it's going to take to reload a black powder weapon.
Right. And that, of course, is the great engine of 17th century black powder play is, that, yeah, you have guns, but you only have them for one combat round.
And it always ends up with the person who is specialized in having the bandolier full of pistols. I always let them start with one, and every time they find another, they add it to the bandolier. And so, hey, now I can pull my second pistol and shoot. Or, oh, I've now got a third pistol. But it's fun. We've also had a lot of, like, I'm busy fighting. I hand my pistol or my musket off to somebody else to have them start reloading, and it allows some of your non-combat characters to have an impact in the combat.
Right.
So it's been a lot of fun.
Cleric/reloader.
Exactly.
Yes.
A secondary skill in black powder reloading.
So the other thing that sort of brings to mind, obviously, is that you're saying you wanted to avoid any of the sort of more historically charged elements of Puritan horror, but if someone wanted to set Hearth and the Harrowing in either an alternate 30 years war in which instead of Catholics and Swedes, you have horrible monsters, or you wanted to set it in an alternate New York where Sleepy Hollow is surrounded by not friendly Mohonk Indians, but surrounded by orcs or whatever, you'd be able to do that in
those. Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, the system is designed to work with the hearth. The powers that we've added for, again, there's that me and my frog, that we've added for, you know, giving characters interesting things to do can all easily be applied to any of the scenarios you just talked about.
And the flavor of the magic to sort of finish, we talked about muskets. We could talk about muskets all day, but the flavor of the magic is not, I'm assuming, pure D&D fireball magic, that it's a little more stepped on.
So we, keep doing that.
It's a natural habit, and so much of what we have done is collaborative, and multiple people. It's an encouraging reflex to give credit to other people. But in this case, it's you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I also worked a lot with the artist that did 95% of the art in the book to ensure that both the art and the rules were aligned and that sort of thing. So when I say we, I generally think about me and my artist, but.
And your artist is?
Her name is Erin Lamoureux, if I'm not butchering her last name. I was hoping to get her at the show this year, but unfortunately she had a conflict. But she's also local to the Austin metro area. So. And links to be able to find her on social are all off my socials and stuff.
Fantastic.
I try to shout her out as much as possible. She actually did some of the art for the show for one of their prizes. But anyways, when I was looking at the magic system, you know, I took BRP and I looked at the different magic systems they had, and I wanted to use the one that could be not only used for magic, but used for if I'm a rogue that can hit harder, or if I'm a fighter, or if I'm playing a surgeon who knows how to stick people in places where it hurts. I wanted a system that I could apply to all those different kinds of skills. So I pulled the BRP magic system, not sorcery or psionics or superpowers, and I pulled the magic system and I said, you know, this works as is for divine and arcane style magic, and then added all of the, we call them maneuvers, that is, if you are not a magic user, these are the things that you can do in combat. So everybody, every character has four powers that they can use. Some of them might be spells, some of them might be maneuvers, but it allows players to have interesting things to do at all times.
And doesn't wind up deforming the setting,
right?
Which is the other problem. Well, again, you and I have, I think, been buddies for forever, and it is terrific. All my condolences to you being a publisher, but it is terrific that you're getting your vision out there and creating something that is both, I think, personal to you and, in my opinion, is grossly still underrepresented in gaming. The notion of playing a game that is pro-social, both, you know, around the table, which they all are, but also within the table. And I think that's a terrific area of play. And I'm really glad that you're exploring that space. And I'm glad you're doing it with muskets, quite frankly.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it.
The British are coming.
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Cannons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time to wander into a subject matter that is so annoying with its prevalence in the current day that I'm glad we never gave it a hut. We just gave it a corner, but it's the corner where weird rumors turn rancid. And it seems like, even though I knew we were in a conspiratorial era, and I think we speculated in the past as to why certain eras are more amenable to conspiracy than others, but certainly ours is. And that means there's fresh new conspiracies bubbling up in the corner all the time. And as a service to our listeners, rather than have you have to go and research these enough to debunk them to the more credulous people you may be drinking a beer with, we will handle that for you in our foremost fun-ruining capacity. This isn't even ruining something fun. It's ruining something particularly dumb and stupid, and that is the new Dead and Missing Scientists flap. As we'll get to in a moment, not the first one, but it's the current one. And if you happen to know any of the people who have been named as part of this, feel free to stop listening to this episode because it's going to keep being about this. And I totally respect how someone who had a personal connection to this story would not want to hear it even debunked at this point. Having said that, Ken, what am I talking about?
Yeah, you're talking about a series of mostly scientists. There's one person who is described with fun optimism as a researcher, and so I don't know that they're a scientist. And there's another guy who's a construction foreman, and he may also have a scientific turn of mind, but he's not in there in the lab with the gluons.
Yeah, so, a sure sign of things being roped in by heavy lifting.
Right. So anyway, the Wikipedia site, which is, I suppose, the sort of base level filter to which the sump sinks, it lists 15 people, including, ironically, conspiracy theorist Nick Pope as the last guy. We're going to leave him off the list because that's a stretch even for this list. But we begin with a University of Alabama physicist working on anti-gravity named Ning Li. She dies of Alzheimer's in July 2021. That Alzheimer's, it transpires, was brought on by a hit and run in 2014. So that's our first question marky thing. Also in Alabama, a anti-gravity, as I say, researcher named Amy Eskridge, and I did not dive into her scientific bona fides, but anyway, she died by her own hand in June of 2022, and no one was paying attention then. Then a NASA planetary scientist at JPL, Michael David Hicks, died of heart disease in July of 23. Another guy who served at NASA and NSA, but was in USAF Intelligence, a guy named Matthew Sullivan, died in May 2024. And it's probably, I mean, it's pills and alcohol. So you draw the conclusions. A guy named Frank Maywald, who is a NASA imaging specialist at JPL, dies in July of 2024. No cause of death given. He's 61. So it's the point where things can happen. Anthony Chavez is the formerly noted construction foreman, but he was a construction foreman at Los Alamos, Robin. So, where we have an ongoing nuclear laboratory, not just the fun one from Oppenheimer. He disappeared in May of 2025. One of those took his gun out into the desert and never came back situations. Monica Reza, a NASA materials engineer at JPL, also disappeared in Angeles National Forest, but her friends who were with her said, we were going along a cliff's edge and she didn't come out of the forest. So yeah, and that was June of 2025. Melissa Casillas, who's an administrative assistant, but also at Los Alamos, disappeared in the desert in June of 2025. They found her remains next to a handgun on May 2026. Joshua LeBlanc, a NASA electrical engineer at the Marshall Space Center. He dies in a car accident in Huntsville in July of 2025. So Huntsville is for cars, I guess. Stephen Garcia, who is a Kansas City National Security Campus, which is where they build the non-nuclear parts of nuclear weapons. And he is a property custodian. And I don't know if that means his job is to manage, did all the klystrons stay in their box, or if he's the guy who cleans up the klystron room. I couldn't really tell. I think the former. He disappears in August of 2025. There's a chemical biologist who works for the pharma company Novartis named Jason Thomas. He drowns in a lake in Massachusetts in December of 2025. This, I think, is one of those, well, he was sort of science-y because there's no nuclear or aerospace connection at all to this guy. A guy named Nuno Lureiro, who is a plasma physicist. And this, by the way, is when it hits my radar. He was working on fusion at MIT and he's shot in a home invasion and everyone was very mystified until they connected it to the Brown University mass shooting, which was carried out by his fellow Portuguese national physicist in December of 2025. And that guy just had a lot of problems with Brown and with his career. And so that's where that guy shows up. Then there's a Caltech astronomer named Carl Grillmeyer. He's killed in a carjacking in February of 2026. And we end, which is, I think, where it hits the news media, with Major General William McCasland, former commander of the Air Force Research Laboratory. And he disappears in February of 2026 once more, takes a gun, walks out into the desert, leaves all of his stuff behind. Nobody knows what's going on. And he has not turned back up.
Right. So several of these, as disappearances go, are not mysterious. That just right. They haven't been found yet.
Right. They just haven't found the body. And this obviously gets some degree of attention because, you know, major generals don't usually just wander away, even retired ones. And so the FBI is saying, we're looking into everything. The NASA is saying, we're looking into connections. The NNSA in Kansas City says, we're remaining vigilant. And these are the types of non-statements that when people ask you dumb questions, you say if you're the government. They also say them when you're asking good questions, which is what makes it annoying. But sometimes if you're in the government, you don't have to say non-statements. You can say utter nonsense. So Representative Tim Burchett, a Republican of Tennessee, says that 8 of the dead or missing are working on UFOs, which seems unlikely. James Comer, the House Committee on Oversight, the chairman of that committee, says the deaths are unlikely to be coincidental and that they're looking into connections. But Trump says, hopefully, just a coincidence. So the voice of reason, our beloved president. There we are.
Yes, in his classic way of saying everything and nothing at the same time and clearing up nothing with every statement.
Now, with real criminal cases, the FBI sort of has to do its job. And so they have conclusively ruled out any other cause for the death of Lureiro, the fusion physicist, than the killer hating his own life and being contemptible. And they say there's no connection to any other case or to any foreign state actor. Both the killer and the victim are from Portugal, but the Portuguese didn't do it and neither did the Chinese or anybody else. So what this pattern, obviously UFO people are excited. People who are worried about China are excited. Everyone's excited. The pattern recalls what they used to call the SDI deaths. and 25 scientists who worked for Marconi, also known as General Electric Corporation in England. These guys in the UK, 25 of them died between 1982 and 1990, many of them working on STI. There was a spate of very colorful and unusual suicides in the middle of that period, and various labor polls and anti-American theorists said this was the CIA killing them after brain draining them, that they'd, you know, or they were going to blow the whistle on SDI in some way, and that's why they had to be silenced. So the conspiracy is a standard find a list of deaths, connect them. And this has also been done with people who are connected to the tomb of Tutankhamun or the assassination of Kennedy or many other, you know, famous big picture things. There's going to be a list of names. And guess what? In a list of names, people gonna die.
Right. This one's a right-coded one. The earlier one's left-coded. Some are, like the Tutankhamun one, have, I guess, anti-mummy curse coded.
Right.
So you can take that template and attach it to whatever your fears and political orientation are.
And if you are interested in sort of the strongest case for a bunch of scientists dead by a conspiracy, then your case is seven, at least, Iranian nuclear scientists who all died between 2007 and 2020, most of them between 2007 and 2013, but they died of a motorcyclist riding up and attaching a limpet bomb to their car, not of mysterious walking into the desert death. So this is what it looks like if, oh, to pick a name at random, Mossad wants you dead. It doesn't look like a bunch of heart attacks and whatnot. So you run the numbers. There's 700,000 people who work in top secret cleared positions in American nuclear or aerospace research. Note that that does not include at least three of the names on this list. Statistically, about 50 of them should die by violence or disappear every year. We are obviously well below that for this list, which goes over a period of 5 years and does not have 250 people on it. So I feel like we are pattern matching animals. Everyone who looks at this case says this is a classic case of, you know, finding a pattern where none exists, finding Jesus in the tortilla. We are evolved to see clumps of nuts in the trees and go after them. And even if it doesn't turn out to be a clump of nuts, we've gotten good exercise climbing the tree. And the trouble is, now that nuts are available in plentiful supply from every corner market, we've still got that part of our brain that's looking at the tops of trees for science murderer.
And there's a whole attention economy now where people are looking for not just conspiracy content, but new conspiracy content. It's no good to be worried about the 3 years ago conspiracy. That's lost all of its brain dopamine for you. So you're always looking for a new thing. And whoever it was who decided to, you know, attach one of these random unfortunate people into this broader story, they got a big bunch of attention for that in whatever forum they were in. And then that got to bleed out into the mainstream. And now it's on Wikipedia. And so there'll be a whole bunch of people looking for other people who match the putative pattern. And as you suggest, the surprising thing is they've come up with that few of them.
Right.
So, of course, that's the sort of thinking that leads us to the esoterists who deliberately stoke conspiracy and paranoia in order to generate the magic needed to draw outer dark entities into our world. And so probably the main issue with this is it's such an obvious one that there's four different esoteric cells, like all like jockeying for territory, trying to be the ones to exploit this thing. And to their next step, of course, would be to engineer some killings in order to fit on the list. And so your challenge as Ordo Veritatis investigators in this one might be to, you know, you have to figure out which of the four cells who are working on this is the real danger and which ones are the wannabes that you can mop up afterwards. You could also have a supernatural being who could notice this pattern and then start to take advantage of it, because it's like, I'm a psychic vampire. I lure people out in the desert to drink their fluons, and I can just get away with it now because people will just attribute it to this. And if I just keep moving, you know, they won't send a Mulder and Scully after me.
It's a classic setup for an ABC killing where the C is for creature as opposed to conspiracy. Yeah, you could also hide vampire predation in one of these lists, or you could have a list and four of them were killed by vampires, but the other seven were not. And the job is to sort of suss out which are the reals and which are the fakes. That could be a part of an investigation in a Knights Black Agents or other sort of investigative horror game. And then finally, I suppose, the nature of these sort of stochastic patterns, creates its own awareness. And in a kind of a esoterist adjacent game, it's the pattern creation that draws out a tulpa. And then the tulpa thinks, I need to go kill people who work in aerospace. That's my job because people believe in me so hard. And that can either be straight Ezo, where the cult has created this or drawn this outer dark guy to continue the work, or it can just be a, this is how things are when everyone's psychic energy is so fraught up on TikTok and such. It's just a great time for tulpas and a banner year for them. And, you know, like the 9-year cicada where you got the 20-year tulpa flood happening now.
Right. And it could turn recursive, that if there is something or someone behind it, they can realize that someone's quasi onto them, even if they're not properly regarded, and go, well, I guess instead of picking on aerospace and government people, I need to get rid of these conspiracy theory people who are blowing my cover. So you could start with trying to protect a reasonably sympathetic person who sort of stumbled into this conspiracy world and adds a name to the list. And then all of a sudden there's a strange man in black driving past their house every couple of nights. And there's a rustling in the attic, and they call their supernatural investigator friends to get them out of the jam they've gotten themselves into. And once we've spun a number of scenario hooks, it's time for us to depart this podcast for another week, but we'll return right back into it. I already said it, a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/Ken and Robin.
Protect this podcast from fatal neck strain alongside such backers as
Daniel Markwig,
Jamie Twine,
Michael Bowman,
Michael Harrison,
and Michael Manival.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindelaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when once again, we will talk about stuff.